Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Guerrilla Radio here on Truth Emerges Radio, the Truth Emerges Network. Tonight's topic will be the evil of the collective. We have open lines you want to call in, 347-855-8301. Press 1. Let me know you're in the queue. Roll the intro and get the party started. Yeah, what better time than now? This is your host, Anarchy Austin Thomas, covering the evil of collectivism today. First of all, collectivism is a cultural value that is characterized by emphasis on cohesiveness among individuals and prioritization of the group over self. Individuals or groups that ascribe to a collectivist worldview tend to find common values and goals as particularly salient and demonstrate greater orientation toward in-group than toward out-group. The term in-group is thought to be more diffusely defined for collectivist individuals to include societal units ranging from the nuclear family to a religious or racial ethnic group. Meta-analytic findings support that collectivism shows a consistent association with discrete values, interpersonal patterns of interaction, cognition, perception, and self-construal. Collectivism is often discussed alongside the cultural value of individualism. Yay! But these are two distinct concepts and not considered to be opposites. Well, I would consider them opposites. The German sociologist Tonies described an early model of collectivism and individualism using the terms Gemeinschaft, which is community, and Gesellschaft, society. Gemeinschaft relationships in which communalism is prioritized were thought to be a characteristic of small rural village communities. An anthropologist, Redfield, echoed this notion in work contrasting folk society with urban society. Weber in 1930 contrasted collectivism and individualism through the lens of religion. Excuse me. Believing that Protestants were more individualistic and self-reliant compared to Catholics, who endorsed hierarchical interdependent relationships among people. Hofseed in 1980 was highly influential in ushering in the era of cross-cultural research making comparisons along the dimension of collectivism versus individualism. Hofstede conceptualized collectivism and individualism as part of a single continuum, with each culture construct representing an opposite pole. Now we're getting somewhere. The author characterized individuals that endorsed a high degree of collectivism as being embedded in their social context and prioritizing communal goals over individual goals. The notion that collectivism, individualism, is unidimensional has been challenged by contemporary theorists. Well, I would challenge it myself. I mean, being an individualist myself. Collectivism was an important part of Marxist-Leninist ideology in the Soviet Union, where it played a key part in informing the new Soviet man, willingly sacrificing his or her life for the good of the collective and fully replaceable. Terms such as collective and the masses were frequently used in official language and praised in agitprop literature, for example, by Vladimir Maykovsky and Bertolt Brecht, The Decision Man Equals Man. The construct of collectivism is represented in empirical literature under several different names. Most commonly, the term interdependent self-construal is used. Bullshit. Other phrases used to describe the concept of collectivism, individualism include allocentrism, ideocentrism, collective private self, as well as subtypes of collectivism, individual, meaning vertical and horizontal subtypes. Inconsistencies in terminology is thought to account for some of the difficulty in effectively synthesizing the empirical literature on collectivism. Typically, collectivism is measured via self-report questionnaire. Meta-analytic findings suggest there are six instruments that have been used to measure collectivism and the related construct of individual in a manner that best reflects current theoretical thinking. Gudnick's and colleagues developed a 28-item measurement tool that rates items on a scale from 1 to 7. Interdependent and independent self-construal subscales are produced. Sample items from the interdependent subscale include: I maintain harmony in groups of which I am a member, and I will sacrifice my self-interest for the benefit of the group. Kim and Leung developed the revised self-construal scale, which is a 28-item measurement that produces interdependent and independent self-construal subscales. Sample items from the independent subscale include: I feel uncomfortable disagreeing with my group, and my relationships with others in my group are more important than my personal accomplishments. Egads. Oyserman developed a measure containing 18 items rated on a 5-point Likert scale, which produces collectivism and individual subscales. An example item from one of the collectivism subscales include: in order to really understand who I am, you must see me with members of my group. The whole point I'm trying to make is that collectivism and putting others before self in this altruism state is inherently evil. If you are willing to put your benefits and the benefits of your loved ones behind that of the group, or participated in the social contract over your individualistic needs, it just doesn't make sense to me as an individualist myself. I mean, you get into these collectivist ideologies, the social contract. which is allegedly an implicit agreement among the members of a society to cooperate for social benefits. For example, by sacrificing some individual freedom for state protection. Theories of a social contract became popular in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries among theorists such as Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau as a means of explaining the origin of government and the obligations of subjects. Which brings me into the basic of a citizen. By definition, is a subject of a nation. Do you see yourself as a subject? Do you see yourself as part of the Borg? A lot of people would answer no, but they're all aboard the Trump train, and they're all collectivists. Sharing the Trump train, get on board the Trump train. And the same shit for Bernie Sanders, the burnouts, the socialists, the social democrats, putting society and others before self. Same thing with the Hillary supporters. You have the same thing with the Trump supporters. You have this basic left-right paradigm, which is in play constantly, where there really is not much difference if you look at things between there's really not much difference between Democrats and Republicans. There's a few issues that they argue about, but for the most part they're both collectivist ideologies. The Democrats want to spend other people's money, taxation, extortion, on social programs, while the Republicans want to spend the extorted loot on things like the wall or the military-industrial complex. Two. So-called protect them from what's in play. The left-right paradigm is a concept from political sciences and anthropology, which proposes that societies have a tendency to divide themselves into ideological opposites. But as we're going to find out, they're really not that opposite. Important contributions to the theory of the paradigm were made by the British social anthropologist Rodney Needham, who saw it as a basic human classifying device. It shares affinity with the cultural romantic classic paradigm. The term is used to analyze political discourse since the 19th century. It has, however, been suggested that the 21st century, the paradigm will be less useful as a tool of social and political analysis. Some of the major current issues, such as global overpopulation, individual liberties, and biological warfare, cannot be said to allow either a left or right perspective. The left-right paradigm as a political criticism, used in another context, the phrase refers to a political theory that alleges that members of opposing major political parties, such as the Republican and Democrat parties in the United States, share common interests and goals, as well as covertly unified ruling authority over the political issues of the masses. Again, that's the collectivist ideology. The two major political entities act in concert to create divisiveness among the population while keeping control of the political spectrum. This left-right paradigm concept theorizes that two opposing political parties utilize their tremendous hold over mainstream media to dramatize political distractions and engage in covert warfare and operations. In grand performances of bureaucratic rivalry meant to propagandize and divide the populace. Divisive issues are purposefully fed through the major media outlets to divert attention away from the ruling class's hidden and ulterior and sometimes global agendas. By drawing attention to differences between the two embedded political systems, ideologies, races, and classes, the political group obscure political clarity and divide unity among the masses. The tactic creates confusion and frustration among the population, which enables the ruling class to increase and consolidate their wealth and power through maintaining an illusion of a two-party system of checks and balances that actually works. The theory contends that the fresh interjection of a new political party or group, such as the expanding Libertarian or Green parties into the political arena, would be the only way to provide a means to break the cyclical paradigm currently established in the political system. Well, I disagree with that too. It all boils back down to the evil of the collectivism and what we have in play with this false left-right paradigm. It's the same paradigm. It's the same thing. Just like this social contract. Just like another thing that we're going to talk about, which is called the common good, another fallacy that is propagated by the oligarchy. The common good is the benefit or interests of all. In philosophy, economics, and political science, the common good, also commonwealth, common weal, or general welfare, refers to either what is shared and beneficial for all or most members of a given community, or alternatively, what is achieved by citizenship, collective action, and active participation in the realm of politics and public service. The concept of the common good differs significantly among philosophical doctrines. Early conceptions of the common good were set out by ancient Greek philosophers, including Aristotle and Plato. One understanding of the common good rooted in Aristotle's philosophy remains in common usage today, referring to what one contemporary scholar calls the good proper to and attainable only by the community, yet individually shared by its members. The concept of common good developed through the work of political theorists, moral philosophers, and public economists, including Thomas Aquinas, Niccolo Machiavelli, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, James Madison, Adam Smith, Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, John Rawls, and many other thinkers. In contemporary economic theory, a common good is any good which is rivalrous, yet non-excludable, while the common good, by contrast, arises in a subfield of welfare economics and refers to the outcome of a social welfare function. Such a social welfare function, in turn, would be rooted in the moral theory of the good, such as utilitarianism. Social choice theory aims to understand processes by which the common good may or may not be realized in societies through the study of collective decision rules, and public choice theory applies microeconomic methodology to the study of political science in order to explain how private interests affect political activities and outcomes. The term common good has been used in many disparate ways and escapes a single definition. Most philosophical conceptions of the common good fall into one of two families, substantive and procedural. According to substantive conceptions, the common good is that which is shared and beneficial to all or most members of a given community. Particular substantive conceptions, which will specify precisely what factors or values are beneficial and shared. According to procedural formulations, by contrast, the common good consists of the outcome that is achieved through collective participation in the formation of a shared will. Let me see here. We'll take a little break here. Thank our sponsors. If I can even get it up. Co-Transportation, we'll start with them. We'll be back in a few minutes, guys.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up and she's running like I never before.
Hey folks, this is The Mouth, and if you need something moved, you need to go through Dadco Transportation. Family owned and operated, Dadco Transportation specializes in pad wrap fixtures to retail stores throughout the country, as well as furniture transportation, pad trap and box furniture from California to Arizona to all points east. Be it truckload, LTL, rollout, exclusive use, or expedited, Dadco is here to service their clients safely, efficiently, and quickly. So if you need something moved within the continental U.S., contact Dadco Transportation at 609-296-9121 or contact them directly at dadcotrans.com. That's dadcotrans.com.
But I can never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight.
This is indeed a disturbing universe.
Yes, all I'm offering is the truth. On Unraveling the Matrix with me, your host, Austin Thomas. Yeah, we like to mess with the taboo stuff that you're not going to hear or see on the lamestream media. Now that you're awake, be aware. Be aware what's in play. CIA and Mossad banking, money laundering, and international organized crime joint venture. Imagine that.
Don't be too proud of this technological terror you've constructed.
Well, we know how these elections are all on the straight and narrow worldwide.
Unraveling the Matrix with Austin Thomas. Saturday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on Truth Emergence Radio Network.
I'm hoping that they're listening to us here on Truth Emerges Network.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room.
You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work,
when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Thank you. when we were colonists and were governed by the British King and Parliament, they devised ingenious means to tax us. One of the most hateful was the Stamp Act. It required that every person in the colonies buy a stamp that bore the image of the king and affix that stamp to every piece of paper in his possession. Question: how did the king know if every colonist was complying with the Stamp Act? Answer: the Townshend Act. This abominable law authorized British soldiers to write their own search warrants. Thus, British soldiers knocked on the doors of the colonists' homes and handed them warrants in which they had authorized themselves to enter, ostensibly to look for the stamps. They entered wherever they wanted, and they took whatever they wished. The colonists were so outraged at these self-written search warrants that Parliament actually rescinded the laws that permitted them. But the offenses to personal dignity and the assaults on private property were too deep. We fought a bloody revolution against the government that did this to us. After we won that revolution, we wrote a constitution to assure that these abuses would not happen again. And to that constitution, we added a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights guaranteed that the government could not on its own assault your natural rights. Among them, that quintessentially American right, the right to be left alone. Today we call this right the right to privacy. The Fourth Amendment requires that the government, before the government can assault your right to privacy and search your possessions, come onto your property, listen to your phone calls, read your mail, monitor your keystrokes on your computer, or even obtain records about you from other sources like doctors, banks, or lawyers, it must present evidence of criminal behavior on your part under oath to a judge. And only if the judge accepts that evidence, and only if the judge issues a search warrant, may the government legally seek and seize whatever is specifically described in the warrant. No more government knocking on doors in the middle of the night and taking whatever it wished. Regrettably, the federal government has labored mightily to get around all this. Even though every person who works for the government has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, many of them seem to spend more time avoiding and evading it. In the days after 9/11, Congress enacted the Patriot Act, an abominable piece of legislation which permits federal agents to write their own search warrants. With the Patriot Act, we have come full circle from the days in which a king unleashed soldiers upon us on their own to the present day in which our elected representatives have unleashed federal agents upon us on their own, all in utter disregard for our natural right to be left alone and the constitutional requirements of a judicially issued search warrant. The Patriot Act, perpetrated by a Republican president and Congress, was and is one of the gravest legislative assaults on human freedom. It was harshly criticized at the time by a young Democratic senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. But freedom must look very different from inside the White House than from outside. This morning we learned from the front page of the Wall Street Journal that the Obama Justice Department, without obtaining search warrants, has been using a computer program called Stingray, which manipulates your cell phone to enable the government to follow you whenever the phone is with you. And last month, the Obama Justice Department told the Supreme Court that it has been installing GPS systems on the cars of those without cell phones so it can follow them. And last spring, the Obama Justice Department persuaded the court to let cops break down doors without a search warrant on the basis of what they think they smell from coming behind the doors. And somehow it claims that the Fourth Amendment is no obstacle to all this. What's going on here? Is this really America in 2011, or is it East Germany in 1961? Would the government prefer to watch all of us, to seize our computer records, to listen to our conversations, to break down our doors whenever it wished, without following the Constitution? Yes, it would. Power by nature expands. That's why we have a Constitution, to restrain governmental power. Who would want to live in a society where the government was unrestrained? Have we fought wars against totalitarian governments only to find that we have elected one here at home? Did you even know that the federal government may be using your cell phone to follow you wherever you go? Have we become a nation of sheep? Sadly, the answers to these questions are obvious.
Certain that we stand at a defining hour. Halfway around the world, we are engaged in a great struggle in the skies and on the seas and sands, We know why we're there. We are Americans, part of something larger than ourselves. For two centuries, we've done the hard work of freedom, and tonight, we lead the world in facing down a threat to decency and humanity. What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind: peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law. Such is a world worthy of our struggle and worthy of our children's future. If it is possible, I want to continue to build a lasting basis for U.S.-Soviet cooperation for a more peaceful future for all mankind. The triumph of democratic ideas in Eastern Europe and Latin America, and the continuing struggle for freedom elsewhere, all around the world, all confirm the wisdom of our nation's founders. Tonight, we work to achieve another victory, a victory over tyranny and savage aggression.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. We're talking about the evil of the collective, and we're going to spin a little bit here. We're going to talk about, is the United States turning into a police state? I mean, look around. You've got militarized police, sophisticated surveillance, and everyday normal people as citizens with little to say in what goes on. U.S. has all the trappings of an all-powerful police state. Look around. A totalitarian state controlled by a political police force that secretly supervises the citizens' activities. So is the U.S. a totalitarian state? Nah. It's an inverted totalitarian state. Here in the U.S. versus Nazi Germany, corporations control the government through political contributions and lobbying. Nazi Germany, the state-dominated economic actors. The U.S., persistent political apathy allows leaders to do what they want. In Nazi Germany, constant political motivation rallies support for leaders with Nuremberg rallies and Hitler Youth. Well, that's kind of interesting because the Trumpster himself is using a little bit of those rallies for support. And then the U.S., of course, pretends to be the model of democracy for the whole world. And Nazi Germany actually mocked democracy. The U.S. is a managed democracy. It's a political form in which governments are legitimated by elections that they have learned to control secretly. Over the last 25 years, civilian law enforcement has been increasingly militarized in America. There has been a 4,000% increase in no-knock military armed SWAT raids over the last 30 years. Yes, that's a 4,000% increase. Even responding to calls about angry dogs and domestic disputes using military tactics and weaponry on U.S. citizens. A common SWAT armament, of course, submachine guns, automatic weapons, breaching shotguns, stun grenades, heavy body armor, sniper rifles, night vision, motion detector, and armored personnel carriers. Now, you look at the most common weapons used by violent offenders, 10, 0.1% of the time it's a knife, 12.7% of the time it's a gun, other is 12.1%, unknown is 7.6% of the time, and 55.8% of the time, there are no weapons. Imagine that. Imagine that, no weapons. And, of course, this, all with this collectivist ideology, the U.S. has the world's largest prison system, you know, the land of the free, but, you know, restrictions apply. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. Yes, 25% and 5%. 1 in 99 adults in the U.S. are behind bars. 1 in 31 adults are under some form of correctional control, which includes prison, jail, parole, probation. I'm gonna lay this out for you. This is the number imprisoned per 100,000 people. This is from 2012 and 2013. And the rates have climbed in the United States, definitely. United States is number one, 716 out of 100,000 people are imprisoned. This is your collectivist, you know, the common good. We're gonna keep, you know, we're gonna make people, we're gonna rehabilitate people. Number two is Rwanda, 492 per 100,000. Number three is Russia, 475 per 100,000 people. Brazil, 274, Spain, 147, Australia, 130. You know, we talk about China and how they are against the people, and they come in at a paltry 121 compared to 716. Their imprisonment rate per 100,000 people in China is five times lower than that of the United States. Canada, 118, Austria, 98, France, 98, Germany, 79, Denmark, 73, Sweden, 67, and then India at 30. Over the last 40 years, the U.S. prison population has risen 700%. That's correct. Over the last 40 years, the U.S. prison population has risen 700%. Now you've got the NSA providing constant surveillance for the police state, wiretapping entire offices, cell towers, with 9,000 tower dumps in 2013. A tower dump is a record of all calls bounced off a cell phone tower within a certain period of time. The NSA gathers nearly 5 billion records a day on smartphone locations alone. Not to mention now, they are in your emails, your tech, landlines too. And even entire countries, but they install these fibro-optic splitters in telecom facilities. Your accounts online aren't safe. Number of data requests from December 1, 2012 through May 31, 2013, that's just 6 months. Yahoo, 12 to 13,000, Apple, 4 to 5,000, Microsoft, 6 to 7,000. Google 1,000, Facebook 10,000. This is 2013. This has been amped up. Actually, the Democrats, in conjunction with the Trumpster, pushed through more of less regulation on this spying on you through the NSA. Less equals more. More of your freedoms eroded away. I believe that we are coming a police state. And then you have the collectivists that talk about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. Just a heads up, guys. North Korea has a constitution, as does China, and as does Russia. I hear all about this, about the Bill of Rights and what it's supposed to do and what it's supposed to protect against. I hear all the time from the constitutionalist collectivists that it's the law of the land, that all these police officers and all these judges and all these politicians and all these police officers and military Bill of Rights, this Constitution. That goes out the window, though. That goes out the window when any pressure is put upon them, the Constitution. And what's really scary and what's really on the increase, especially with Mr. Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump not even understanding in a big meeting with a bunch of sheriffs across the country, I think it was like his fourth, fifth month in office. He's talking about, what do you guys need for more asset forfeiture? Do you need me to sign an executive order? Civil or asset forfeiture in the United States is out of control. They call it civil forfeiture, civil asset forfeiture, civil judicial forfeiture, occasionally civil seizure. It's a controversial, and I'll put this loosely in quotations, legal process in which law enforcement officers take assets from persons merely suspected of involvement with crime or illegal activity without necessarily charging the owners with any wrongdoing. While civil procedure, as opposed to criminal procedure, generally involves a dispute between two private citizens, civil forfeiture involves a dispute between law enforcement and property, such as a pile of cash or a house or a boat, such that the thing is suspected of being involved in a crime. To get back seized property, owners must prove it was not involved in criminal activity. Again, I want to read that to you again. In order to get back the seized property, the onus is on them to prove it was not involved in criminal activity. Sometimes it can mean a threat to seize property as well as the act of seizure itself. In 2015, for example, Eric Holder ended adoptive forfeiture, which occurred when the state or local law enforcement agency seizes property pursuant to state law and requests that a federal agency take the seized asset and forfeit the seized asset under federal law due to abuse. Now, this is the thing, this adoption thing, this adoptive forfeiture, Jeff Sessions is opening this up again. So one slightly good thing that Eric Holder did to get the federal agents out of this forfeiture racket has been undone by Jeff Sessions, you know, the guy that's also ramping up against the weed. You know, they want to take your cannabis away and take your shit away. But again, those states proceeded to curtail the powers of police to seize assets actions by the Justice Department and Jeff Sessions have sought to reinstate police seizure powers to raise funding for federal agencies and local law enforcement. Now, the problem with this is you've got agents of the state, police officers, seizing your property based on a hunch that they feel it's involved in an illegal activity, suspicion. Now, proponents see civil forfeiture or asset forfeiture as a powerful tool to thwart criminal organizations involved in the illegal drug trade. Ah, yes, the war on drugs. With $12 billion annual profits. Since it allows authorities to seize cash and other assets from narcotics trafficking, they also argue that it is an efficient method since it allows law enforcement agencies to use these seized proceeds to further battle illegal activity. That is, directly converting value obtained from illegal items for law enforcement purposes by harming criminals economically while helping law enforcement financially. Critics argue, and this is one of them, that innocent owners can become entangled in the process to the extent that their right to property is violated. With few legal protections and due process rules to protect them in situations where they are presumed guilty instead of being presumed innocent. Further, critics argue that incentives lead to corruption and law enforcement misbehavior. Well, duh. There is consensus that abuses have happened, but disagreement about their extent as well as whether the overall benefits to society are worth the cost of the instances of abuse. Here we go around the horn again to that common good and the benefit to society over the individual. The benefit to society, again, over that of the individual is what they actually use to carry on this terrible, terrible, terrible. I mean, this civil forfeiture laws, these are so archaic. These go back to British Navigation Act, which allowed seizure of ships and goods on suspicion, mere suspicion of wrongdoing. Now the civil asset forfeiture or asset forfeiture actively increased from the war on drugs 1980 to present in the past 30 years. 40 years, actually. It stepped up from forfeiture during war on drugs during the early 80s and onwards. It became harder for criminal organizations to launder dirty money by means of the financial system, so drug cartels preferred bulk payments of cash. Illegal drugs are a big business. Yeah, ask the CIA. They've got deals in Afghanistan. One estimate was that the annual profit from selling illegal drugs was $12 billion. That's according to the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. The initial intent, similar to methods used to try to fight alcohol trafficking and used during Prohibition era, was to use civil forfeitures as a weapon against the drug kingpins. According to journalist Sarah Stillman, a major turning point in forfeiture activity was the passage of the Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 84. This law permitted local and federal law enforcement agencies to divvy up the seized assets and cash. Forfeiture forfeiture allowed federal and local governments to extract swift penalties from white-collar criminals and offer restitution to victims of fraud, according to Stillman. From 85 to 93, authorities confiscated $3 billion of cash and other property based on the federal asset forfeiture program, which included both civil and criminal forfeitures. The methods were supported by the Reagan administration as a crime-fighting strategy. It is now possible for a drug dealer to serve time in forfeiture-financed prison after being arrested by agents driving a forfeiture-provided automobile while working in a forfeiture-funded sting operation. That's the Reagan Attorney General Richard Thornburg in 1989. Politics of civil forfeiture were somewhat unusual. The federal forfeiture laws were introduced and pushed through by the Republicans in the 80s with some support from the Democrats. But efforts to reform forfeiture laws have also come from the right, as libertarians in Congress, well, I'd like to see one of those, have focused on the basic idea that as offensive to property rights in many areas, civil forfeiture adversely affects persons from minorities in low-income communities, in which the typical seizure is less than $500. And the Democrats have also been critical of civil forfeiture programs. The ACLU, a longtime opponent. Forfeiture was used for purposes other than trying to discourage illegal drug activity, such as attempts in New York City to discourage drug driving. Forfeiture rules were used to confiscate cars of intoxicated motorists. In such instances, there are two types of cases. A criminal case against a drunk driver as a person, and a civil case against the property used to facilitate the drunk driving, specifically the car. So, for the criminal case, you are presumed allegedly innocent until proven guilty. But for the property case, the car is already guilty and you have to prove the car was innocent of not driving drunk. I mean, this is the reality of what is in play with these civil forfeiture laws. This was being curtailed in many local and state communities. Now Sessions wants to expand this adoption program through the federal government and take away all the gains that were made by ACLU and by people fighting to reform this sinister asset forfeiture. I'm going to cut the show short tonight. I'm going to spend the last few minutes. Of course, everyone's talking about the Austin bomber, and it wasn't me, even though my name's Austin. But apparently the question is out, who is Mark Condit, the suspected Austin serial bomber? This is from Pflugerville, Texas. The Austin bombing suspect, who blew himself up Wednesday in a confrontation with police, was an intense loner who grew up in a tight-knit, deeply religious family, according to friends and neighbors. Mark Condit, 23, could sometimes get angry over a misremembered Jeremiah Jensen, who knew Mr. Condit because they were both homeschooled in Pflugerville, a town 20 miles north of Austin. Okay, so here's the narrative already being spun. He was an intense loner, tight-knit deeply religious family, homeschooled. Do you see where this is going? Mr. Jensen said he was one of the few people who tried to push through Mr. Condit's hard-to-get-along-with exterior. He said Mr. Condit was not overly political when they were growing up, but seemed to like debating issues and probing logical extremes. He could be dominant in conversation, said Mr. Jensen, 24, who now lives in Dallas, has not been in touch with Mr. Condit frequently for the last 4 or 5 years. It would seem like he was trying to argue with you and give pushback on things you were trying to say. It didn't have to be serious. He liked to debate. On Wednesday, authorities across Austin area carried out a sprawling search for clues about Mr. Condit's passions and motives, as well as other explosive devices he may have left behind before he blew himself up early Wednesday morning as the police closed in. Brian Manley of the Austin Police Department said that Mr. Condit had made a 25-minute recording in which he discussed the bombs and how he had made them. The recording, Chief Manley said, was the outcry of a very challenged young man talking about challenges in his personal life that led him to this point. In Pflugerville, authorities swarmed a home where Mr. Condit had been living with two roommates, a location that Governor Greg Abbott told reporters could contain a treasure trove about the suspect's motives and methods. The roommates, of course, were detained for questioning, and one had been released by Wednesday afternoon, according to the Austin Police Department. Investigators also searched the nearby home of Mr. Condit's parents, including several backyard sheds on their property, but they had not found any explosive devices by Wednesday afternoon, Detective David Fugit, a homicide detective with Austin Police, told reporters that the Condit family was cooperating. We don't have any information to believe that the family had any knowledge of these events, Detective Fugit said. They're having a difficult time. This is certainly a shock to the conscience. Family, friends, neighbors, and former classmates were at a loss to explain why Mr. Condit had carried out the attacks, how he had learned about bomb making, or whether he was driven by a racial means. The first bombs hit members of the African American families who were well known locally, killing a 17-year-old boy and a 39-year-old man, Mr. Condit, was wife. Mr. Condit grew up as the quiet, here we go again, socially awkward oldest child of a devout Christian family that held Bible study groups in their white clapboard house where the American flag hangs from the front porch. After Mr. Condit, 23, was identified on Wednesday as a serial bomber who killed two people and terrorized Texas's capital, Mr. Condit's mother sent a text message to a friend, Donna Sebastian Harp, and said, "Pray for our family. We are under attack," a reference to a spiritual assault. "It's a Christian thing we say," Ms. Harp said. "Pray, the situation is very serious." Governor Abbott told the television station KXAN that Mr. Condit did not have a criminal record. Did not serve in the military and was unemployed. He said it appeared that Mr. Condit had acted alone, but authorities had not definitely ruled out whether he had any accomplices. In 2012, Mr. Condit hashed out some of his views on a blog that he created for a political science class while he was a student at Austin Community College. Jessica Vass, a college spokeswoman, said that Mr. Condit had attended from 2010 to 2012 as a business administration major. McKenna McIntosh, who was a political science class with Mr. Condit, said that the views on the on his blog called Defining My Stance were as clear as day. In another author bio on the site, Mr. Condit described himself as a conservative, but said he was not that politically inclined. His sixth post, which date from January to March 2012, include arguments in favor of the death penalty, against the legalization of same-sex marriage, and in support of the end of sex offender registries. So he's a little bit across the board there. The blog does not discuss Mr. Condit's views on guns or gun control, but Ms. McIntosh said that the topic was often discussed and that she did not recall Mr. Condit ever advocating violence. He also said she did not recall any class discussions involving Mr. Condit's views on race. In his profile for the blog, Mr. Condit wrote, "The reasons I am taking this class because I want to understand the U.S. government, and I hope that it will help me clarify my stance and then defend it." Pamela Crouch, who homeschools her children in Pflugerville and has known the Condits for several years, said her family attended a Bible study group at the Condit home in the early 2000s. When both families belonged to a small evangelical church, Grace, that has since shut down. Ms. Couch said the church had an economically and racially diverse congregation, described the family as lovely people, and said that Mr. Condit's mother did some work outside the home as well as homeschool their four children. Real estate records show that Mr. Condit and his father, William Condit, bought what a neighbor described as a 1950s era house together in Pflugerville in 2017. And a neighbor and family friend said the younger Mr. Condit and his father had been remodeling it. They treated it as a rebuilding bonding project over the course of a year, said Mark Rossler, 57, who lives across the street. He described the son as courteous, unassuming, and very quiet. Other neighbors said they saw little of the younger Mr. Condit. "I think he was pretty much a loner," said Jay Scholes, a network engineer who lives two blocks down, adding that Mr. Condit spent most of his time with his parents. Mr. Condit worked for a local manufacturer, Crux Manufacturing, for about 4 years until he was fired this past August, after he failed to meet job expectations, the company told a local television station, KVUE. Katie Burke, a receptionist at Platinum Gymnastics in Pflugerville, said Mr. Condit had also worked for a gym around 2012 when the gym was under different management at a separate location in Round Rock, Texas. Jeff Reed, 75, a neighbor of Mr. Condit's parents, said the Condits had never expressed concerns about their son to him. "I can tell you nothing about him personally, except that he was a nice young kid," Mr. Reeb said. "He always seemed like he was smart, and he always seemed like he was very polite," Mr. Reeb added. "My summation is it doesn't make any sense. As it never does. There are always going to be the bad seeds in society." And on that note, I'm going to put this one in the can. This has been your host, Anarchy Austin Thomas, here. Talk the evil of the collective, social contract, all that good stuff. Putting another one in the can. Peace out, everybody, and much love. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys Saturday for Unraveling the Matrix.